Juan LaQuinta. I'm an addict. My name is Mitch.
Hey, Mitch.
I'll just tell you this. This is pretty much of an honor to be asked to do this, and I know it's not an accident, although I don't really part of me would say I'm not really qualified from my active experience in taking place of a lot of the NA history from the beginning. All I do have is my experience, my strength, and my hope. And that's all that anybody has coming into Narcotics Anonymous with any kind of workshop or any kind of speaker in any kind of meeting. I'll just tell you that my clean date is 2/10/85.
21 years.
And celebrated 21 years in February. And used to be in conventions. I used to go to a lot of conventions, and all the conventions I'd go to, somebody would speak, and they'd share for 5 minutes. They'd get down, and then somebody else would come from the audience and come up and share. And that would give people, gave me an experience to feel what it feels like to come up to the dais, which is something I'm not crazy about anyway. You know, people say, stand up. I say, I am standing, you know. Anyway, what I remember, all I can do is tell you what I remember, and my memory is very, very short-lived. Used a lot of drugs for a long time, 17 years, I never missed a day. had a lot of physical unmanageability, which I call, now I can have unmanageability clean, and what I remember coming into Narcotics Anonymous was that somebody came up here in the meeting that I was at and shared something that blew me away, and I couldn't believe that they were clean. I kind of knew them a little bit, you know, or heard of them. They had like a reputation in the Catonsville area, and I would listen to them, and I'd look, and I'd say, man, this guy can stay clean. Maybe I can too. And what it did, it gave me a glimmer of hope. And that's all I needed, was that little glimmer of hope. You know, my home group is called Alive in Pikesville. And I've been kind of like politicking, I guess, to try to. It's a candlelight meeting, 8 o'clock. It's really nice. And I've been kind of politicking to have it change to a glimmer of hope. Because that's all I got when I got here to Narcotics Anonymous. I got that glimmer of hope, you know. I heard about some type of little mustard seeds and things like that. But when I started really understanding what Narcotics Anonymous was for me, that's what I got. I got a glimmer of hope in my heart that maybe this thing can work for me. And obviously it has. I've been clean 21 years. And I've stayed clean, and I worked program the best of my ability, and I guess I could always do better in my life. I had a couple months clean. I'm from the northwest area, the Free State region, and this guy dragged me to a meeting that they had at St. Elizabeth's Church in Patterson Park, where they were going to divide the Baltimore area. It was just the Baltimore area at that time. It was, I guess it was February, it was February 1985. And they were going to, discussion was, the meeting was to specifically subdivide Baltimore because it was just starting to get too big. Now, what I remember, there was about maybe 10, 12 meetings or something, 15, but they were divided. You know, they had Randy J. out in the Bay Area, Annapolis, and then Vince was like, you know, kingpin over here in Catonsville area, and Shelly L. was kind of involved in the Baltimore area. And they went, and this guy, my first sponsor, Joe P., he dragged me to this meeting. I mean, I had a week, 2 weeks clean. I didn't know anything. I come to this meeting, and these people were sitting around this table, and there was bikers there, and there were and there's some just raggedy-looking people, man. And they started cursing at each other, F you, and this and that. And I was like, yeah, this is right on, man. This is. They start. I mean, I thought they were going to go fist to cuffs. I thought they were going to start pulling knives out and stuff. And I was like, yeah, man, this excitement rules. And this is what I really, that's what, of course, I dug the adrenaline, you know. And at the end, it seemed like there was a little bit of a calming down point. But what they had done was they had actually made a triangle. They had actually divided. They had a Baltimore area. Then the Bay Area was formed. I guess I was there when it happened, so I guess I was part of the NA history in that area. And then the Baltimore area and West Side. Vince West Side, Shelley Baltimore, and Randy Bay. And I think it still stands like that today, except I think Shelley lives down here. Anyway, the only thing I remember as the history that I remember, and I saw a lot of literature being written, and I was involved in some of that, kind of indirectly, directly. I gave some ideas what they were doing. They had policy committees, and my sponsor, Mason D, at the time, used to drag me. This was about a year after, 6 months after the areas divided and Mason came. Now, what happened was I was told, let's go to this guy's anniversary. And it was his fifth anniversary, and I think Kermit was there. And it was in, where was that? I think it was in Virginia or West Virginia, and it was in a cabin. And the same kind of thing went down. There was all these bikers, and I get there, went there with Bly, rest his soul. He's no longer with us. And he was very instrumental in helping this region, CMP region, form a policy committee for this region. Robert Bly. And he got killed when he moved out to New Jersey. He got hit in a step van, got thrown out. And Mason chaired his fifth anniversary, and I saw this little guy there, and all these big bikers, these real tough-looking guys, and this little guy might have been like 5'3 or something, kind of grayish hair, little goat beard. He had so much power in his voice. He had all these guys like, he was like holding court, and he had all these guys listening to him with intent, with intensity, and they really respected what he said. And I found out this guy was Mason's sponsor. His name is Larry North. And that's where I met Mason, and he was my first sponsor. And he gave me a lot of information, and I know he was the Chesapeake and Potomac Regional's RSR alternate, which was Regional Service Representative. I don't know if they have that anymore. And then they don't. That's how long I've been out of that regional service. And then he became the RSR, Regional Service Representative. And he taught me what it was about to be in commitment and to have commitment in Narcotics Anonymous and to do service. And that's where I learned about service. When you're asked to do something, you do it. I certainly didn't want to do this. I felt like it's a thing for Bo Sewell or who was that guy that was supposed to do this? Some guy named Dutch. So Dutch gave this to us, but I crossed out Dutch. I said, no, God gave this to us. And what I saw and what I learned was just so incredible now from my point of being able to see how the basic text went from the second edition, where the fourth and the ninth traditions had been completely changed, which gave a complete change to the meanings of those traditions from the second edition, and then the World Service Conference Office / whatever became. Then we had the third edition, then the third edition revised, the fourth edition somebody from the other fellowship wrote, and then we have now the fifth edition. I think they're trying to change that again. It's like, you know, if it works, don't fix it, right? But I was able to see, and here's what I participated in, how it works and why. I was part of that process in seeing that book get written, and I have a couple. Anyway, I want to stop talking. Kermit's with us today. Randy's with us, and I think I'd like to hear from those guys. Thanks so much for letting me do this. I appreciate it.
Okay, I'd like to introduce to you now Randy.
I'm an act named Randy.
Hey, Randy.
Thanks for leaving me up here alone, Mitch. Anyways, I'm going to talk more about the history as it relates to me and my history in Narcotics Anonymous and some of the things that I've done and been involved with while I've been in Narcotics Anonymous through the service structure. I've had the dubious honor, first of all, of sharing this with you. I don't know much about history because I'm basically a newcomer when it comes to history. I've only been clean for like almost 18 years, and Narcotics Anonymous is like 50 years old, so I feel like much of a newcomer. But I've been involved with some interesting things in Narcotics Anonymous. I saw this fellowship go from a United States fellowship to a worldwide fellowship. And the reason why I say that is because when I first became a conference participant in 1994, it was a U.S. fellowship, basically. And the thing is you what I saw happening in Narcotics Anonymous is one thing the American fellowship never realizes is that they can go into a meeting and they have literature, right? And I come from a country where there's another language that is spoken, and we need a literature in another language. And I had the dubious honor of taking meetings into areas where, you know, one profound thing happened in 1989 that I recall that really started the flavor of a true international fellowship or worldwide fellowship known as Narcotics Anonymous. What happened is at the 1989 World Service Conference, the Canadian regions got up and left. Because they did not think it was a worldwide fellowship. Their needs weren't getting addressed. The majority of the vote was coming from the United States, and they didn't feel that they were getting their needs met, and so they got up and left. I was a part of the first Canadian assembly of Narcotics Anonymous, and what that helped do was create literature in a French language. Also, literature was being written in Spanish at that time. And so we were starting to reach out to some of these fellowships that were where there were addicts, but they couldn't understand what it was we were doing because they didn't have the literature. Here in the United States, there was always that assumption that you people never had a problem because you can walk into any meeting and read the literature. You knew what was being read. You knew what was being said. We also had another unique problem because there were, and it says somewhere in our service literature about independent areas and isolated areas. And we were once in one of our step-in tradition meetings, we were once discussing this about being like in an isolated area. Now, an isolated area to me meant somewhere like up in Labrador or Inuvik, where there was maybe one person per every 5 square miles. And some of these people were sniffing gasoline, you know, some of these people on these reservations. And I had part of the honor of taking meetings up into Labrador, onto Indian reserves, and onto Inuit reserves. I think you call them Eskimos down here, which is, like, really rude. But I had the dubious honor of taking meetings onto Inuit reserves and like, sharing what was known as what we have is Narcotics Anonymous, and that there is help for people. And you see, I can only relate to my own history, right? I also was a conference participant through 1994 and 1997 when the service structure of Narcotics Anonymous changed, when this fellowship did an inventory about what we were actually doing. Because back on August the 17th of 1953, a couple of guys got together because they used to share in these alcohol meetings about being addicts and stuff, and the alcohol people didn't want those people there. So those guys got together, a few of them, and they decided to get together at somebody's house and have a meeting and talk about what they did, and that was Jimmy Kennan and a few other people. I don't know what their names were, and they got together in this house in Sacramento, which is now a car lot. It's a purple house. It still stands there, and they still use cars there. And it was 1953. They had a meeting, and then And they had a few more meetings, and then for a while it disappeared. And then in New York, people were getting together and talking about drugs in meetings outside of those alcohol meetings. And then in a few other places here in the Northeast, people were talking, going to meetings. And then all of a sudden in California, it started up again, like somewhere in the early 60s. And that's what I know about the history of Narcotics Anonymous. And Jimmy Kennan used to take notes in meetings. He would take notes about what people were sharing. He'd write the stuff down. And then he would sit at his typewriter and start typing stuff up. And I saw some of these papers that came off of his typewriter once when Betty Kennan decided a few years ago that she needed some money, and she sold his filing cabinet to the World Service Conference. That was in 1997, and it was full of the actual original writings, which are now on display in the office in Chatsworth when you walk in there. But and the thing was is that they started creating this literature. Kermit has a piece of it, actually. And they started passing around this stuff. And the words of Narcotics Anonymous started reaching out farther than just Southern California and up in New York. And sooner or later, it got all over the states. And Mitch talked about what was going on here in the Baltimore area. What was going on? Like, I joined the Canadian Fellowship when in 1988 we had six meetings in a city of 3 million people, and we were like a bunch of rats in one pack that would just jump from one meeting to another. We didn't know what to talk about because nobody was working any steps, so we talked about using because that's all we had. I came into the fellowship about 7 years after the basic text was released, before It Works How and Why, and I was grateful to be a part of the process of the step working guide. When that came out, at the time Kermit was sponsoring me when I was a conference participant, and you know I was telling him about these papers that were being passed around and that we should give a bit of feedback on. But I tell you, during that specific time in Narcotics Anonymous, the mid-90s, when all this literature was coming out, it was only like a few people doing it. I mean, it wasn't really going out to the fellowship the way it did with the basic text and It Works How and Why. There was a few responses, but most of it was written by about five or six people, edited by about five or six people, and voted on by the conference. So that's how a lot of that stuff came to be. I was also a part of the process when the Guide to Local Service came out, when they split up that big red book, which was birthed from Twiggs, the working guide, the temporary working guide to service, and then they had that big red book for a while that George Holloman wrote, and then they split that up, and they took a Guide to Local Service, and they're still confused about what World Services does, but they actually identified what the local service structure does in this wonderful guide. I remember Judy once sharing about it. If you haven't read it, go find it once. It's a pretty interesting piece of work. And I was actually part of that process that adopted that, because when the change at World Services changed from a service body that had subcommittees and stuff like that to a service body that was just a board and a pool of members, that was a big deal. Now, there's some work that still needs to be done in there, but in the early 1990s, Narcotics Anonymous was growing a lot faster than we could have imagined at the time. So in 1993, there was an inventory taken. And in 1994, 95, they started a composite group, which became a transition. And we transitioned World Services to the way we were doing business in the early 1990s to the way that they're doing business now. And to me, it functions a lot better. But unfortunately, it's still that small group of people that do it. And it keeps recycling itself. I'm glad I'm not part of that anymore. I mean, I did learn a lot when I was there. I miss being part of the Canadian Assembly because we were still doing stuff that was, I guess, what the developmental forum does these days, like in places like China and stuff like that. I mean, we to go up into the Northwest Territories in the Yukon and carry the message of NA, it's like, you know, you're stepping on real virgin grounds where people, all they know how to do, because, you know, you're going into very impoverished areas of Aborigines who, you know, they're not smoking crack and stuff like that. They're drinking gasoline. I mean, that's how they're getting off. And it's really interesting to see what it is. And we're talking 10 and 11-year-old kids. And they're dying from this stuff. And realistically, you go into some of these communities and you think that there's no hope because what have they got? Snow and ice. A few moose come through and a few polar bears, but that's it. You know, I've got to see that even with a few people, this message does work, and it works everywhere, and it works in a lot of different languages. And I'm so grateful now that Narcotics Anonymous now is producing languages in many, many different flavors. It has truly become a worldwide fellowship in a very short period of time. And realistically, that's the only history that I know of. I mean, Kermit used to be my sponsor, and he knows a lot more about this stuff because he was involved. And I would just like to call him up here for a couple of minutes just so he can share some of his experiences, because realistically, that's all I've got as far as my history goes. And thank you for letting me share.
Okay, with all that out of the way, we're going to have Kermit come up and share.
Which one's live and which one's Memorex? Well, to them it probably does. My name is Kermit and I'm an addict.
Kermit.
Clean today through the grace of God and Narcotics Anonymous. My clean date is September 6th of 1981. So in 5 months I'll be picking up 25 years clean in Narcotics Anonymous.
That's
still like pinch me, you know, because I couldn't get 25 days. Oh, God. I'm supposed to be in the comedy show. That's right. I had to listen to these two jokes. No. Ka-ching. Usually I talk about the history of Narcotics Anonymous. Oh, thank you. I talk about Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob as the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Bill Wilson basically wrote the big book with a lot of help from a lot of people. And he was sitting in a room as he was starting to writing and thought for about a half an hour, and he came up with the 12 steps. And he had been, before that, he was getting sober in the Oxford movement, which was like a semi-religious, semi-four-step program of, you know, surrender and make amends and share openly with others and help others. And I got to see what happened was, once that book was written with a lot of help, it went around the circle from the New York AA group to the Akron, Ohio group, and they would like write notes in the liners and stuff, and tell that sponsor to shut up. And when it came back, you know, they did a bunch of group conscience that way, and I saw the steps that Bill had written, and they're real interesting because there were some differentiations from what we have today. It talked about the seventh step to humbly on our knees, holding nothing back. You know, and the part that I thought was real interesting was in the 12th step, Bill had written, having had a spiritual experience as a result of this course of action, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics, to others, especially alcoholics, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And the AA members at that time changed that to carry the message to the alcoholic, who still suffers, because it was their primary purpose. So that's why we have carry the message to the addict who still suffers today. My understanding is that Bill realized that once you have a spiritual awakening, you'd be of service to anyone, right? The first inklings of 12-step program for addicts came out of the federal detox in Lexington, Kentucky. In the 1940s and the 50s, if you wanted to get clean, there was only one place in America to go to, and basically you had to be a convict to go there. It was the detox in Lexington. And alcoholic named Houston Sewell from Montgomery, Alabama, was trying to help a friend of his get off of meth, get off of morphine using the 12 steps. And the guy never got clean. But Houston moved to Lexington, and he met up. He went in there and talked to Dr. Vogel, who was the director of the hospital. And he suggested to him about having a program for addicts to use steps. And they started something in that program called Addicts Anonymous. And they had steps. And there was a guy named Danny Carlson. He was an addict from New York, and he was a good addict. He went through this program 9 times. On his 9th time, he finally surrendered, and he went back to New York, and they started something in 1949, early 1950, called Narcotics Anonymous. And they had meetings, and they had even a meeting at Rikers Island in the Tombs. They were doing H&I. But they were very into, you know, social work, you know, getting people housing and clothing and all this other stuff. And they had a board of directors for this, a board of trustees, and no addict was allowed to be on it. Danny died from cancer, and his sponsee mentor, this woman, Ray Lopez, took over. And to give you an idea, that her office was in the New York City Narcotics Bureau. And half of her office was New York City Narcotics Bureau, and the other half was Narcotics Anonymous. The inklings of the fellowship using the 12 steps was floating through this, through the federal detoxes. They'd opened one up in Houston, Texas, and of course Dr. Vogel was connected with them, and they started meetings there. And a lot of those guys were coming in from California and other places on the West Coast. The, you know, Randy was talking about the first meeting of Narcotics Anonymous. They actually had a business meeting. Jimmy and some other people got together because the meetings they were having out there, they had meetings called HFD or habit forming drug meetings. And a lot of them were hot seat meetings and, you know, what we used to call TCs. You know, people call them treatment centers. We call them torture chambers. You know, if you're, you know, childish, they make you wear a diaper. And if you're vain, they make you walk around with a mirror in front of you all day long. And if you're a baby, you got to wear diapers. But a lot of that stuff was confrontational, you know, because the only thing that people had figured out was that addicts had big egos. And they knew that if they could deflate the ego and they could get them to help somebody else, they might have a chance. So Jimmy and some people got together, and there's a specific date on the minutes, and I have a copy of those minutes. And they, the first motion was to form the San Fernando Valley AANA. And Jimmy said, "You guys are out of order. You can't use the AA name." And they ruled him out of order, but they agreed to write to AA World Service. And they got a letter back saying just what Jimmy said. You can't use the name, but you can use the steps. So they changed in the later minutes to change from San Fernando Valley AANA to Narcotics Anonymous. Now, when you think about Narcotics Anonymous and the name that we have and have had for over 50 years, in the 40s and the 50s, everything was a narcotic. Marijuana was a narcotic. Cocaine was a narcotic. You know, it was all narcotics. So to them, it made sense. And we had a lot of discussion during the early 80s. I was on the World International Committee because people in other countries were saying, "Your name is wrong." Go, yeah. You know, we should be Addicts Anonymous, or we should be recovery, you know. But when we talked to people, nobody wanted to give up their NA T-shirts. That was as close as we could get to getting them to change their look and changing the name. I'm going to jump ahead because there's only 20 minutes here. But that little group, you know, what happened and what Jimmy always talked about is powerful personalities. Powerful personalities will kill NA. And, you know, they had this one guy, Cy Mallow. He was a powerful personality back then. And they got a call at the office. Somebody said, "Where do you want this check?" And they said, "What check?" "Well, we have a $100 check. This guy named Cy Mallow gave a talk, and we're supposed to pay him $100. The only meeting in the world was, it had boiled down to one meeting in this place called the Schreier's Dryer. It was a dry-out hospital, and they called it the Schreier's Dryer. And it was a show of hands meeting, and, you know, I thought that meant, you know, you raise your hand and you get picked. A show of hands meeting was they'd ask how many addicts are in the room, and they'd raise their hand, and they'd say how many alcoholics. If they had more alcoholics, they had an AA meeting. If they had more addicts, they'd have an NA meeting. One of the old timers went by to see what was going on, and there was nobody there. There was a basket with a few bucks in it and a few pieces of literature. The only NA meeting in the world died in 1959. And Jimmy and some other people put it back together, and they started up at this place called Moore Park. And we were in California a few years ago, and we got to see a meeting called 30-something. And everybody who was in the podium had like 30 years or more, and they'd all gotten clean in that Moore Park meeting. And it was the most powerful thing I've ever seen, because you look at these people and they were just a bunch of addicts sitting in a room trying to stay clean. And they were sitting in front of 30,000 NA members who were clean today because of their efforts, because they just kept and stuck it out, you know? The growth of NA is in two parts. There's several parts. One is that if you looked at the timeline, it was a perfect God thing. All the 60s hippies were getting burnt out by the late 70s, right? At the same time, the United States government changed the laws to say that alcoholics could no longer be looked at as criminals, but they had to be looked at as sick people. And once they changed that law, it was allowing insurance money to pay for treatment. And once that happened, the treatment industry was created overnight. Now, the treatment industry, they didn't even know, they didn't have any counselors. There was no such thing, you know, a few dry-out places. So they looked to where people were getting the help, you know, were doing the best, and that was the old AA 12-steppers. So those guys came in and wrote all the first literature, and of course they told people to send the people to what works, you know. The other thing that was the growth of NA was the group of people in Atlanta. There was people trying to write a book. Nothing was getting done. And there was a group of people in Atlanta that had 7 meetings a week. And this one guy named Bo S. From Atlanta went to California to find out who was writing our book, you know. And he went to the World Convention in San Francisco in, I don't know, 78, 79, I believe. And he was asking, and at that time, in, you know, about 5 minutes, you met every mover and shaker in NA. You know, here's Jimmy, and here's, you know, and they introduced him to Greg Pierce, who's passed away. And Greg was at the center of power, and he was trying to get people to write something. And Bo and Greg got together and started to talk. And that talk was the formation of the beginning of the basic text of Narcotics Anonymous. See, Greg said that Bo was like the P.T. Barnum of N.A. You know, he could get people excited about a cause and riled up, you know, and ready to go. And Bo went home and he started writing. He would sit in meetings, like he said, and write and write and write. And he came back to the World Conference that year, and they elected him chairman of World Literature with a mandate to write a basic text of Narcotics Anonymous. And they didn't know how to do it, right? They went to they created their first World Lit meeting was going to be Milwaukee, I guess, Wichita, I'm sorry. And they picked some place that was dead center, and it was right near the time of the World Convention. And thank you. And they had a meeting to write the basic text. And what they came up with is that they figured they're going to take the chapters out of a little white book, right? Who is an addict? Why are we here? What we read in the meetings. And then they took all the literature that they had, and they cut it up into little thoughts and ideas. And they looked at it, and they said, okay, does this fit in recovery and relapse? Or does this fit in why are we here? Or does this? And they would take all those little pieces, and they put them on a page, and they kind of try to fit them together. And they'd read it out loud. They'd do what they call flow read, and they just read it. And people would kind of make notes, and then do some correcting. And the basic text is basically a paste and cut and paste job, right? Miracles were happening while stuff was being written. You know, a friend of mine was typing in the words that, you know, they'd given him a sheet, and he was typing it in, and it said, we dreaded the past and we were fearful of the future. And he kept typing, and we weren't too thrilled about the present. And it got in the basic text. This wonderful woman named Gina from Nashville, she was the first person to die from AIDS in NA, and she wrote that line, everything we know is subject to revision, especially what we know about the truth. The other man is my sponsor, Greg Pierce, who passed away. And Greg Pierce he wrote the NA Tree, which is a service. Is this off now? Which was the first service structure we ever had in NA, and it connected all the groups in the world. And there wasn't a lot back then. It was a mid-70s project. Greg wrote the Triangle of Self-Obsession. He was self-obsessed one day, and he sat down and wrote the thing. He wrote the first four-step guide we ever had. He wrote the IP Living the Program, where you can write those pieces every day. And he wrote the entire tradition portion of your basic text in Narcotics Anonymous. They asked him, they had him write the first draft, and they turned it over to the Board of Trustees, to Group Conscience, the World Literature Committee did, and they came back with hardly a single notation changed. You know, he was a very great man. You know, he would travel for business, and in the early 70s, the flights were inexpensive, and he could match up three or four cities in one flight. And he would do that and just pick cities, and he would go try to find NA in those cities of the one or two people and let them know, you know, what's going on. I'm going to end with one quick story. My sponsor, my first NA sponsor, Joseph, got clean in Memphis, Tennessee. He got clean over the telephone. He went to the library looking for something. He had 2 years in AA. He was on lithium and smoking dope, and he was getting ready to pick up his two-year cake, and he knew it wasn't working. So he called. He got a number out of the library for this thing called NA in California, and he called Collect, good at it, and he got Jimmy K. And Jimmy talked to him about a complete abstinence, and Jimmy told him, you go start a meeting. And he said, and you hug everybody who comes in that door. He said, because if you're not willing to hug everybody, you won't stay clean, and neither will they. He said, and if you have it in the back of your mind that you're going to get in their pants or you're going to get in your wallet, you won't make it, and neither will they, because you'll alter the way you carry your message. Mm-hmm. You know? My sponsor, Joseph, heard what Jimmy said to him, and he stayed clean, and they have NA in Memphis. And that was repeated in city after city. In New York, they called Jimmy every week, every day almost, to what's going, what do we do, what do we do? There's so many meetings, there's so many addicts, and there's so many things. And they called from Australia, and they called from Ireland, and they called from Germany, and they called this man. And this guy had NA in his kitchen. For the mid-70s, late 70s, when you called Narcotics Anonymous, you got Jimmy K's kitchen. I'm clean today, thanks to Jimmy K. Thanks.